several peer-reviewed papers that you probably haven't heard of punch some serious holes in the climate crisis alarmism cult. Even though more evidence links COVID boosters to increased cancer, Canada is still to get more shots delivered by this December. Canada will need over 1 million new homes to deal with our housing crisis. Even though church attendance is down in the West, worldwide, Christianity is still growing. Our goal, as always, is to bring you news, culture, and politics from a distinctly Christian, conservative, and Canadian perspective. It's April 16th. I'm Andrew DiBartolo. This is Liberty Dispatch News Brief. Friends, make sure that you sign up for our Politics in the Pulpit conference. Registration for Weston, Nova Scotia closes Wednesday morning, April the 17th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. You'll still be able to join us at our two other locations. We're going to be in Ingersoll, Ontario on May the 4th, which is faster approaching than you might think, and New Westminster, British Columbia on May 25th. That's just over a month away. You can head to libertycoalitioncanada.com/politics-in-the-pulpit and register today. Seats are limited, so secure your spot now. If you would like to financially support and donate toward the costs of the conference so that I can fly first class and enjoy steak on my flights, but not really, then you can email us at churches@libertycoalitioncanada.com and we will direct you. Again, libertycoalitioncanada.com/politics-in-the-pulpit. Make sure you register today.
Did you know that Salesforce, HubSpot, and MailChimp have been censoring Christian and conservative voices? SalesNexus is the only email marketing solution engineered to protect your freedom of speech. SalesNexus is everything your team needs in one easy-to-use package. SalesNexus has the tools to measure and automate everything. Try SalesNexus free for 30 days and get two users for the price of one with promo code SUCCESS.
So it was over a year ago that Professor Angus Dalgleish published his concerns regarding his many melanoma patients that were relapsing after several years of remission. He realized that all of them, 100% of them, had received a COVID booster shot between 3 weeks and 3 months of their cancer's resurgence. Now, he had referenced a Cleveland study showing a greater than threefold increase in COVID infections in those who were boosted, and a large-scale Israeli research study reported in the BMJ that found a significantly increased risk of COVID infection after a second dose. So Professor Dalgleish has just published an article citing a peer-reviewed paper that was published last week from Japan titled, quote, "Increased Age-Adjusted Cancer Mortality After the Third mRNA Lipid Nanoparticle Vaccine Dose During the COVID Pandemic in Japan," close quote. You got to love the titles of these studies, by the way. It's so long. It's almost like a Fall Out Boy album. And if you get that reference, then I'm sure you appreciate that. Anyways, the study compares the full official statistics by annual and monthly age, adjusted mortality rates for the years 2020, 2021, and 2022 with regression analysis. So this is Professor Dalgleish's summary of the study. Quote, "The results are astounding. It shows that there was a deficit for all cancers in the year 2020, when the first and second COVID waves occurred. In 2021, there was an excess of deaths of 2.2% and 1.1% increase in cancers. However, by 2022, the excess deaths had increased 9.6% and cancer by 2.1%. This paper was completed and published before the 2023 figures release, which will almost certainly be much worse. What is remarkable here is that we are talking mortality, that is deaths from cancer, not incidence of it," close quote. So this is a bombshell of a study here that was done in Japan showing the connection, the link between receiving your third and subsequent mRNA shot and seeing a resurgence of cancer, or as Dr. Ryan Cole from Idaho was saying at least a year and a half to 2 years ago, he was calling it turbo cancer, seeing it grow and seeing people who were otherwise in remission, all of a sudden now it was coming back much stronger than it was before. We also have Dr. Scott Atlas. He's the Robert Wesson Senior Fellow in Healthcare Policy at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And he's a former member of the White House COVID Task Force. He recently did an interview with PragerU. We have the link. I highly recommend watching the whole thing. And in this interview, he describes, among other things, why people were and still are correct to distrust both our elected officials and our unelected health bureaucrats. Now, while he's speaking primarily of the United States, what he's saying is just as true for us here in Canada in terms of what we can expect or what happened with our elected officials and our unelected health bureaucrats. Now, here's just a sample of what he says it was like being in those meetings with the COVID task force at the White House.
In the first meeting, I remember there was some statements made that were completely wrong about the risk to children. And Vice President Pence said, well, we all agree with this, right? Because I hadn't said anything at that point, and I was the newcomer, the outsider. And he sort of saw the look on my face that I probably didn't agree. And he said, well, Scott, you're here because we want to hear what you have to say. And I said, okay, I totally disagree. And that became sort of a catchphrase that my friends in the White House would say, because I said it so often, I totally disagree, because these people were completely wrong. And the sad part was they had no data. There were these sophomoric charts tabulated by Deborah Birx that a middle school student could put together with color coding, arbitrary categories of red, yellow, green, danger, risky, not a risk, but they were just arbitrary. The cutoffs for cases, for whatever the criteria was, there was no real science or scientific debate, except when I was asked a question, I was prepared with a dozen, two dozen scientific papers, all the data I'd gone through with the skepticism about the study designs that you're supposed to have as a medical scientist. And so when I was asked a question, I would go through the data. And there was never a single meeting, and this is sort of shocking to even keep reliving, not a single time where Deborah Birx or Anthony Fauci or Robert Redfield brought scientific papers into the meeting. Not a single time was anything I said ever refuted by criticism of the data or our alternative numbers or other data. Not a single time was there a criticism about a study being designed, except for me, when I would say, of course, as a medical scientist for decades, the way you look at a study is you look at the study design first. If the study design is flawed, the conclusions are not valid. Not a single time did I ever hear Redfield, Birx, or Fauci ever criticize a study design. And even worse, not a single time did they disagree with each other, which, of course, is unheard of, implying that they were just there was a groupthink going on, not critical thinking. But the bottom line of not a single time is not a single time did they disagree with me on data. The only comment was, Scott, you're an outlier. Which, of course, is not the thinking, not a scientific argument. It's not a debate. It's not a way to have a discussion. You discuss the data. Instead, it was ad hominem, you're fringe, you're an outlier. And it's also the thinking of a bureaucrat, because it's not the way any scientific conference I've ever attended was. It's not the way we do discussions of scientific data. It's not appropriate. So it should be very frightening to everybody who's watching this to even know this, that the people running and advising on the medical science, advising the medical policy, were not medical scientists. They were bureaucrats. Fauci was in his position for 38 years. Deborah Birx was a government employee for 40 years. These were bureaucrats. They didn't act like scientists. They didn't think like scientists. They didn't know the data. And when they were wrong, because they were typically wrong, everything they were saying, and I was showing the data to show they were wrong, they were frustrated rather than coming back and having the engaged discussion.
So let me put these stories together for you. In summary, the jabs do immeasurably more harm than good. Our elected officials know this, and they refuse to either debate it or to change their tune. Now, why does this matter? I mean, this matters for a whole bunch of reasons, but let's address a contemporary reason why this matters. Aside from destroying lives, it's still costing us billions of dollars. In Canada, according to documents obtained from BlackRock's reporter, Liberal Health Minister Mark Holland revealed that Canada is still being forced under contract to purchase new COVID shots, even as the Department of Health has thrown away $1.59 billion worth of expired shots. Holland said this in a December 6th briefing note, quote, "As additional vaccines were authorized for use in Canada, manufacturers increased production capacity and demand from Canadians decreased. Overall wastage increased. Additionally, as new formulations have been authorized for use to address variants of concern, wastage of older formulations has increased." Close quote. Canada continues to waste taxpayer money on COVID shots that are increasing incidence of cancer, among many other negative effects, and they still say it's needed to keep us safe. They cannot be trusted. They also cannot be trusted regarding climate alarmism, because just like COVID, they're telling us it's an existential threat that must be dealt with, and they do so because they're concerned with the health and safety of Canadians, so they say. Now, what they are is a climate cult, and they're demanding that we worship their gods their way. Alex Newman, who Mike Thiessen has interviewed before, was recently being interviewed regarding climate alarmism, and he pointed to three studies that have received no coverage in legacy media, of course, and they refute many of the climate claims. So one study titled, quote, "Evidence of Urban Blending in Homogenized Temperature Records in Japan and in the United States, Implications for the Reliability of Global Land Surface Air Temperature Data," close quote. Again, gotta love these titles. It has this under the heading, "Significant Statement." This is right from the study, and we've linked to all these studies and these papers as well in the description. Quote, "Most weather station-based global land temperature data sets currently use a process called statistical homogenization to reduce the amount of non-climatic biases. However, using temperature data from two countries, Japan and the United States, we show that the homogenization process unintentionally introduces new non-climatic biases into the data as a result of an urban blending problem. Urban blending arises when the homogenization process inadvertently mixes the urbanization warming bias of the neighboring stations into the adjustments applied to each station record. As a result, the urbanization biases of the unhomogenized temperature records are spread throughout all of the homogenized data. The net effect tends to artificially add warming to rural stations and subtract warming from urban stations until all stations have about the same amount of urbanization bias," close quote. In other words, let me just boil that down for you. When you set up temperature measuring devices in an area that has not been urbanized, then you record the temperatures, and then the area develops into an urban city area, and you still measure the temperatures, while it looks like a warming of the climate, what it really means is that cities with buildings and cars and more people are warmer than farms are, but it has nothing to do with climate change. It has to do with the simple nature of an urbanized area producing more heat and more energy and generally being warmer in terms of temperature records than a farm, for example. So it totally skews the data and makes it look like, oh, it's been warming. And this study shows that's actually not the conclusion that you're to draw when we look at these temperature measuring devices. It's a very, very important study. Then we have this other study that Alex Newman referenced titled, quote, "The Detection and Attribution of Northern Hemisphere Land Surface Warming from 1850 to 2018 in Terms of Human and Natural Factors, Challenges of Inadequate Data," close quote. Now, this is from the study's abstract. Quote, "Important challenges remain for the broader detection and attribution problem of global warming. One, urbanization bias means a substantial problem for the global land temperature data." That's what I just mentioned. Okay. "Two, it is still unclear which, if any, of the many TSI, that's total solar irradiance, time series in the literature are accurate estimates of past TSI." So it's difficult to look at these time series of what they measure as total solar irradiance and compare the accuracy of past measurements to present ones. And three, this is right from the abstract here, "The scientific community is not yet in a position to confidently establish whether the warming since 1850 is mostly human-caused, mostly natural, or some combination," close quote. In other words, scientists, climatologists, are not in a position to say with any measure of confidence that the warming since 1850, as they measure it with what we've already seen, are not very accurate tools of measurement to begin with, has been caused mostly by humans, not at all by humans, or some mix of the two. I mean, that's a staggering statement to make, because the whole push behind the climate cult is humans are causing the warming. And so by taxing us into oblivion and by wasting money and by retrofitting and by devastating livelihoods, we're going to save the planet. But these studies show we actually can't say whether or not humans are a large contributing factor to warming. And we can't even say with confidence how accurate the warming is, because our detection and measurements have been faulty and have been based on improper information and calibration. So that's, I mean, these are massively important studies, which, as I said at the beginning, you probably haven't heard of. But I would recommend you check out the links, check out the studies, because despite all this information, what's clearly the case is the march into climate communism continues, led by our elected officials and unelected health and other scientific bureaucrats. The past couple years have been some of the most uncertain times for employment and businesses in Canadian history. Have you ever considered owning a business where you can be passionate about your work and make a good living by helping others, but are worried you might fail? Well, ProFleet Care is a franchise organization that is dedicated to helping people find financial freedom and take control of their livelihood through good workmanship and honest business practices. With a 40-year proven business model, ProFleet Care is a unique and comparatively low startup cost business in the growing rust protection industry. Low initial investment, low overhead cost, good margins, training and business mentorship, and an established brand are some of the benefits that come with joining ProFleet Care. So if you're interested in joining ProFleet Care's franchise organization, you can go to profleetcare.com. It's profleetcare.com. Or you can call Greg Laurie at 905-741-5316. We have several other news stories to round out our episode today. First of all, the Parliamentary Budget Officer has released a report titled, quote, "Housing Formation and the Housing Stock," close quote, and surprise, surprise, we need more homes. So in short, if we want to close Canada's housing gap, we need to build 1.34 million additional homes by 2030. This is from the report, quote, "At the national level, we define the housing gap as the number of additional units that would be required to return the total vacancy rate to its long-term average by 2030, accounting for suppressed household formation. Estimates suggest that household formation surged above pre-pandemic levels, reaching 460,000 net new households in 2030, well in excess of record net housing completions of 242,000 units, close quote. What this means is that we need about 181,000 more homes each year for the next 6 years. This comes from True North News. Quote, the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation estimates a significantly higher figure to close the gap at 3.5 million more homes built by 2030 if Canadians would like to see housing affordability return to 2003-2004 levels. Parliamentary Budget Officer Yves Giraud acknowledged the major difference in estimates between the CMHC report and his own by saying that his report was projecting solely from the perspective of closing the gap between supply and demand without factoring in affordability, which just sounds like politicians speak to me. Still from the article, housing affordability is still a major factor at the moment. However, with Canadians currently facing some of the lowest levels of affordability on record. According to a recent report from RBC, the average household in Vancouver has to spend 106.3% of its income to cover home ownership costs. Other cities, such as Victoria and Toronto, saw similar deterioration, with households having to allot 80.2% and 84.8% of their incomes towards mortgages, respectively. Housing affordability in Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax is at or near all-time worst levels. Ottawa's aggregate measure reached an all-time high of 49.9%. Montreal also reached a record high needed income for housing costs at 53.3%. Halifax, whose average aggregate measure was 31.9%, jumped to 45.3% of income required to spend on housing costs, close quote. So if those numbers mean anything to you, I mean, you need to get out of these massive cities, or you need to make a whole ton of money. I mean, that's unbelievable. The average household in Vancouver has to spend more than the entire of their income to cover your ownership costs. How can you actually pay for a house? It's pretty bananas. It's pretty bananas what's going on. Let's continue. A quadriplegic man in Quebec has chosen to receive doctor-assisted murder after a hospital stay ended in him receiving bed sores. Norman Meunier, his arms and legs have been paralyzed since 2022 after a spinal cord injury. Meunier went to a hospital in Saint-Jérôme, Quebec in January for a respiratory illness, and he was sent to intensive care where he spent 95 hours on a stretcher. He was in the emergency room for 4 days. They didn't have a specialized bed for him. Meunier developed bed sores and a major pressure ulcer to the point where muscle and bone were exposed and visible. Meunier has opted for doctor-assisted suicide rather than deal with, as he says, the physical and psychological suffering from the bed sores. So he said this in a Radio-Canada interview. Quote, I don't want to be a burden. At any rate, the medical opinions say I won't be a burden for long. As the old folks say, it's better to kick the can, close quote. I mean, that's a making light of him now legally killing himself. It's a very dark statement, a very, very twisted place that we've gone to in our country. Dr. Stephanie Green, an advocate for doctor-assisted murder, had this to say regarding Meunier's case. Now, listen to what she says. Listen to what the words that proceed from the mouth of this ghoul. Okay? Quote, this is not, should not be, and ought not to be hijacked to be a conversation about MAID. This story is about a major failing at an ER that left a man ill. That terrible mistake should not be reflected on the cardiology service at the hospital down the road, the GI service in another city, or the country's MAID program, or the price of rice in Beijing for that matter, close quote. This is so her comments are, this has nothing to do with a man legally killing himself. This has to do with a hospital who didn't do a good job. And the hospital didn't do a good job. For whatever reason, inadequate care was provided for this man. But to say that this has nothing to do with our country's push to legally killing people for essentially any reason is a foolish thing to say. Krista Carr, the executive vice president of Inclusion Canada, a rights advocacy group for people with disabilities, had this to say about Meunier's case. Quote, "It's just a terrible testament to where things have gotten in our society that we would think death provided by the state would be an acceptable solution to alleviating the suffering of people with disabilities. We know there are thousands of people with disabilities in this country who, when they have access to the right supports, live really good, happy, healthy, and positive lives. Meunier's case is particularly tragic because it resulted in certainly significant harm to the individual and family, but also in a death that should never have had to happen. When we first brought in our MAID legislation in Canada, it was for people who were terminally ill. It was for people who were suffering intolerably, whose death was reasonably foreseeable." Close quote. Except that anyone who understands the death cult that rules our elites knows that the goal was always more death. It was always more destruction, and it was always more devastation of the image of God in humans. It was never just a little bit. We're just going to kill a few people. We're just, abortion is safe, legal, and rare. It's never that. We know that this bloodthirsty death cult is always about more death. And the slippery slope argument fallacy isn't a valid claim to make when we're already most of the way down the slope, ready to launch off a ramp into destruction. So we've been warning that it's obviously moving in this direction. It's obviously moving to more death and more destruction. And this is not going away. This movement to the ending, the legal murder of people for what our state would want any reason, isn't going away, and Christians have to get their act together fast. The church, more broadly speaking, has flopped on preborn baby murder, totally dropped the ball. We cannot afford to be silent and disengaged on what is going to be a significant and increasing cause of death in our country with each passing year, which is what we see when we look at the numbers. The percentages of death from doctor-assisted murder are going up, and they're going up at an alarming rate. Now, Lifeway Research published their Status of Global Christianity, and you might find the results surprising. It turns out that so far in the 2020s, the third decade of the 21st century, the number of atheists in the world is actually shrinking, from 165 million in 1970 to 146 million this year. If the current trend holds, atheism will be represented by no more than 133 million people in 2050. Now, quick side note, these are self-professing atheists because we know atheists don't actually exist because we're biblical. Romans 1 is clear. Every person knows God exists, and the Lord has revealed it clearly to everyone, so no one is without excuse. Nevertheless, this is still interesting. Also interesting is that globally, the rate of professing Christians is also growing, 1.17% per year in 2020. By the middle of 2024, there will be 2.63 billion professing Christians, and at present rates of growth, more than 3.33 billion in 2050. This is from the Western Standard covering this finding from Lifeway. Quote, "For Canadian Christians who mourn the decline of the church in this nation, such statistics might seem like an exaggeration or even a falsehood. But that's only because they haven't reckoned with the reality that most Christian growth now occurs in the global South. As Lifeway author Aaron Earls reports, in 1900, twice as many Christians lived in Europe than in the rest of the world combined. Today, more Christians live in Africa than any other continent. It doesn't stop there. By 2050, Latin America, 686 million, and Asia, 560 million, will boast more Christians than either Europe, 497 million, or North America, 276 million. All of this is being accomplished, by the way, in a world where a vanishingly small number of governments show any favor to the followers of Jesus, and where instead most governments oppose Christianity. Almost nowhere does the Christian receive favors for an open expression of faith, and in most areas of the world, to confess Christ is to invite added difficulties, if not open persecution. Nevertheless, Christianity continues to expand throughout the world. Close quote. Are all of these professing Christians actually born again followers of Jesus, truly following Christ with a sincere faith? Probably not. But was Jesus telling the truth when he said that he would build his church and that the gates of hell would not prevail against the advancement of the kingdom of God? Yes, he was. And that, dear listener, is the greatest encouragement I could offer, even after we've highlighted some of the news in our country for you today. Well, there you have it, friends. You're all up to date. Make sure you head to libertycoalitioncanada.com/politicsinthepulpit and register for our Politics in the Pulpit Conference. I look forward to seeing those of you who will be there this weekend at Weston, Nova Scotia, which again, you have until April 17th, Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time to register. Join us at Ingersoll, Ontario on May the 4th, or come to New Westminster, British Columbia on May 25th. You are not going to want to miss this one. Until next time, Galatians 5:1. Liberty Dispatch has been brought to you in partnership with Liberty Coalition Canada and Christian Week, and has been produced by SDG Media. You can find all things Liberty Coalition Canada at libertycoalitioncanada.com.